you know, I've tried with many of these chairs to raise them. Very difficult.
One of these professors.
They can't touch the floor.
This meeting of the Senate Energy, Environment and Energy Committee will come to order. We're going to continue on our two-part hearings on climate change, and today we're going to be focusing some on starting out with the state agencies reporting on where we stand right now, the greenhouse gas inventory. We'd like to start with the PCA. You are here. Welcome to the table, and please identify yourself and go ahead with the presentation. And I believe we all have packets and copies in our packets.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Frank Polash. I'm manager of the air assessment section at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And today the focus of my presentation will be on the sources of greenhouse gas in Minnesota and our emissions inventory process. The Pollution Control Agency has been compiling emissions inventory data for greenhouse gases for more than a decade. And over the past 6 years, we have submitted three reports on the biennial reports on progress for greenhouse gas emission reductions under the Next Generation Energy Act. The most recent report, which did receive some press coverage recently, was just published last week, and I believe that those have been forwarded to the relevant House and Senate committees. And when we do our data estimations, we currently estimate greenhouse gas emissions back to 1970 levels, and our most current year for greenhouse gas emission estimates is through 2010. The lag in time in the data is due to the lack of data availability on a timely basis. So it takes quite a bit of input data for us to assemble the greenhouse gas emissions inventory. So 2010 data is the most recent data we have available. The first chart that I show here is overall greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota. The yellow part of the graph shows greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota since 2005, which is the baseline year for the Next Generation Energy Act reduction goals. The greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota have, between 2005 and 2008, were relatively stable with a small fluctuation. Greenhouse gas emissions declined significantly in 2009 due to the economic recession, rebounded slightly in 2010 due to the economic recovery. The recession caused reductions in energy use, which then led to reductions in greenhouse gas emissions from the electric generation sector. It also led to greenhouse gas emission reductions in the industrial sector due to reduced industrial output. To look at how the greenhouse gas emissions are estimated for Minnesota, we break these up into these categories here, these major economic sectors of electricity generation, transportation sector, the agricultural sector, industrial sector, the residential sector, commercial sector, and then waste. The drivers for Minnesota greenhouse gas emissions are electric generation, transportation, and then we also look very closely at the emissions from the industrial sector because those do fluctuate more on a year-to-year basis. This pie chart shows the breakdown for the 2010 emission estimates, showing that electric utility and transportation account for more than 50% of the emissions in Minnesota. Looking at the same data, but over a long time horizon, 1970 to 2010, we can see the overall trends for greenhouse gas emissions from these various sectors, again showing the dominance and the importance of electric greenhouse gases from electric generation and from the transportation sector. This graph in 2009 to 2010 shows, again, the impact of the economic recession on electric generation emissions and on industrial sector emissions in 2009 and 2010. Looking more closely at one of the more important sectors, the electricity generation sector, This pie chart shows for 2010 the proportional breakdown of emissions across the various types of fuels that are used in Minnesota to generate electricity. And this pie chart showing that in 2010, 65% of the greenhouse gas emissions from electricity generation in Minnesota came from the use of coal. 28% comes from electricity imports. Under the Next Generation Energy Act, the Pollution Control Agency is required to include electricity imports in the greenhouse gas emissions inventory for Minnesota. And we do that, and then we create a emission factor that allows us to calculate a greenhouse gas emission estimate for those imports. And then natural gas accounting for 5% of the greenhouse gas emissions in the electricity sector. Again, looking at the electricity sector over the 1970 to 2010 time horizon, this again shows how the use of coal to generate greenhouse gases, to generate electricity in Minnesota, dominates the greenhouse gas emissions for Minnesota in the electricity sector. And to note that electricity generation types that do not create greenhouse gases, such as solar, wind, hydro, are not included in this graph because they do not have emissions, and that the carbon dioxide emissions from the burning of biomass are not included in this graph because the Next Generation Energy Act excludes those from the calculation. Looking at the transportation sector as another important sector, another important source for greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota, for 2010, this again shows the proportional breakdown of emissions coming with a large majority of them coming from on-road mobile vehicles, light-duty trucks, cars, and heavy-duty trucks, tractor-trailers, semi-trailers, with the other types of transportation filling out the rest of the pie chart. Looking at the trends.
Senator Benton had a question.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Kolach?
Yes.
I'm going to pronounce that correctly. Just a quick clarification. Under light trucks, is that like SUVs, Ford Rangers, or do you mean box trucks? That I just want to be clear where some of our vehicles might be included.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, the light-duty trucks, it does include pickup trucks, SUVs, those types of vehicles. Looking at the trends for the transportation sector from 1970 to 2010, again, shows how the emissions from on-road vehicles, cars, light trucks, and semi and tractor trailers and the heavy-duty trucks continues to dominate the emissions, but showing a reduction in 2009-2010 due to, again, the economic recession, but also due to improving vehicle fuel efficiency standards that are starting to come in to play at the federal level and are starting to find their way into the fleet of Minnesota's vehicles. This graph should...
Mr. Kolach, on that last point, how much of that dip in the last year, I mean, roughly speaking, how much of that was due to more efficiency, how much was due to less driving because of recession or whatever? Do you have any clue?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a specific breakdown, but I think much of it was due to the reduced fuel use, which was our vehicle miles traveled had been relatively stable, but it was due to less fuel used during that time.
So more efficiency?
I think it's safest to say it's a combination of both the fuel efficiency and just the reduced fuel use from reduced vehicle use. This slide shows the general trends in those major economic sectors with agricultural sector, the industrial sector, the residential sector, and the waste sector showing slight increases in greenhouse gases from 2005 to 2010. Electric utilities, transportation sector, and the commercial sector showing reductions between 2005 and 2010 in the greenhouse gas emissions, and the overall reduction from 2005 to 2010 for greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota is down by 3% from 2005 levels using a 2010 base or a 2010 comparison year. And the final chart that I would like to show is a per capita greenhouse gas emission rate. And this, for this graph, we use 2000 as the baseline for the comparison. So 2000 would equal 1. And what this chart shows is that in 2010, our per capita greenhouse gas emissions are at 91% of the levels that they were in the year 2000. And this indicates that Minnesota is becoming more efficient in its energy use, especially for electricity generation and for transportation, and therefore leading to a reduced per capita greenhouse gas emissions.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, does nuclear play a part in that? Does nuclear emit much greenhouse gas?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, nuclear does not emit greenhouse gases as part of its directly as part of the electricity generation. So there's not a subcategory of nuclear in our electricity generation sector graphs. With that, I will turn the presentation over to Assistant Commissioner David Thornton to speak about the Minnesota Climate Change Action Group.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David Thornton, Assistant Commissioner for the Pollution Control Agency. Before I talk about the Climate Change Advisory Group, I also wanted to put this emission information into a little bit of context. This report came out last week, and some of the first questions we got were, so how are we on track for meeting the next-gen energy reduction goals of 2015 and 2025 and such? And it's hard to take information like this and come up with a solid projection, but I was quoted in the paper saying it looks like it's doubtful that we'll meet the 2015 goal, given how much further we'd have to reduce and how many years we have left to do it. But we recognize that that's something that's on a lot of people's minds. And so one of the things that we're trying to do right now is forecast emissions out into the future, which is sort of a difficult task. It's about like forecasting the weather out into the future. You can do it, and you have to put some boundaries on the accuracy of the information. And we're just in the process of doing that. As you can imagine, since the Next Gen Energy Act was passed in the mid-2000s, a whole lot of things have changed in our lives. We have a whole new economy. The price of gas, natural gas, dropped, and so the use of natural gas has changed how we generate energy. There's a lot more renewable energy on the system. And so we're trying to take all of that into account, all of the things that have changed in the last 10 years, and come up with some new forecasts for where we'll be in terms of emissions. And I'll just show you a teaser. This is what we've done for transportation emissions. This is our projection of transportation emissions out to 2025, starting back in 1990. And you can see, as the graph Mr. Kolesch showed you, shows that emissions began to drop around 2008 or so, we're projecting that transportation emissions are going to continue to drop. And that's going to be largely, the future drop in these emissions is going to be largely due to the federal fuel efficiency standards that EPA has promulgated for mobile sources. So that's good news. And so we're taking this same kind of approach and looking at a forecast for the energy sector. We're working with folks in the Division of Energy over at Commerce on that. And we'll be looking at some other sectors, and hopefully we'll have some better information on that in a few weeks. But I'm mostly here to give you a short review of the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group. Many of you weren't around when that actually was taking place. It was convened by Governor Pawlenty in 2007. It was a stakeholder process. It was envisioned to be a consensus-building process that involved 56 stakeholders from a wide variety of public and private sector organizations and citizen interests. The group was tasked with coming to consensus to build a menu of options that the state could take to try to meet the Next-Gen Energy Act greenhouse gas emission reduction goals. And, in fact, there are multiple references in state statute that refer to the advisory group, the Next-Gen Energy Act goals, and the need to develop a plan, and the plan needs to meet the Energy Act goals. So that was basically the charge to this group and the mission. The group met for over a year, broke up into smaller work groups. There was a work group that looked at residential, commercial, and industrial emissions. Although some industrial emissions come from processes and from boilers, a lot of that is mostly the energy used to run lights and heat buildings and cool buildings in the summertime. There was a group that looked at energy supply, which focused on the natural gas as well as electricity, primarily electricity. There was a group that focused on transportation and land use, one that focused on agriculture, forestry, and waste management. And we even had a group that was looking at cap and trade. Back in those days, people were talking about cap and trade as one way out of this problem, and we had a group that did some work on that. Altogether, they came up with about 50 specific policy recommendations. The recommendations were general in nature and did not really provide much detail in terms of how one would implement them. But there was quite a bit of information in this report, which if anyone's interested in going back and looking at, we have links to it on our website. The policy initiatives were ranked in order of how much greenhouse gas reductions might be associated with implementing those initiatives. They were ranked according to their cost effectiveness, how much it would cost to implement them versus how much emissions could be reduced from it. And you're going to hear from Deputy Commissioner Grant in just a few minutes, and he's going to talk a little bit about some of the major things that have happened since the Climate Change Advisory Group report came out. But I just want to add some caution up in front of that. Back in 2007, this group did the best it could with the information it had and the way we understood things at the time. And so a lot of assumptions had to be made in terms of what kind of benefit you get from planting trees, for example, or what kind of benefit you get from certain types of crop management. And we know more about those things now, and I think that one thing that we've learned in the last few years is that some of the assumptions that went into a lot of the work that this group did were well-intentioned and the best at the time, but are probably wrong. And we would certainly recommend that there be some effort made over the next period of time to go back and sort of refresh some of that work with more current, up-to-date understandings of how things work. But I will show you this final graph. The red line is greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota under a business-as-usual case. And this was a 2007 business-as-usual case. And so, as I've mentioned, the world is different now than it was in 2007. And one of the things we want to do is recast that red line to see where it really is now. The green line is projected greenhouse gas emissions after things that were already on the books here in Minnesota were implemented. And that would be, for example, among other things, requirements to use biofuels, the renewable energy standard, requirements to reduce or to improve energy efficiency, and things like that. The purple line represents a linear picture of what the Next Gen Energy Act reductions would have required. You don't have to make specific reductions each year, but the two target dates on this graph are 2015 and 2025. And then the light blue line that superimposes the purple line was what was expected to be possible to achieve if all of the Climate Change Advisory Group recommendations were fully implemented. And that showed that it would be possible to achieve those reduction goals if everything was done. So that's, Mr. Chair, just a quick overview of the Climate Change Advisory Group. My last slide just shows some contact information for me as well as for Deputy Commissioner Grant. If you have questions about any of that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or move on and let the next speaker.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Thornton. And we will make sure. I know, as you or your predecessor mentioned, that the report has just come out last week, and I know I got it. I don't know if every member of the committee did. We'll make sure it goes to every member of the committee. Useful report. Mr. Thornton, though, the question I have is on the second last, the last graph. When the MCAG report was done seven years ago, we would reach the goals if we did all the things in there, as their estimate was at the time. Is that still the current assumption, and assuming that assumes that we're going to do all of the things in the goals?
That was certainly the way that that graph was developed back then. I think that, to be honest, if we were to refresh some of those assumptions with what we know now and go back and try to recreate that graph, we would probably see that if you summed up all of the recommendations that came from MCAG, they would not probably achieve the emission reduction goals.
Okay. So obviously, in other words, to reach the goals,
we're going to have to do some more thinking.
And I think in the next year, this committee may be spending some time trying to figure out not only what strategies one might use and taking a look at it, because I think, as you pointed out, a lot of new information has been available in the last 6-7 years. Questions from the committee. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Thornton, reading the statute, it's the first time I've actually read it, and that's a little embarrassing because I've been here a while. But 80% below 2005 levels by 2050, is there some place where it's documented what everyday life would look like with an 80% reduction?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, I'm not familiar with anyone that has really tried to look that far out into the future as to how you would get there and what it would mean in terms of how we light buildings and get from place to place. I think that the assumption that a lot of people have used is that there'll be a lot more renewable energy and electric cars and those kinds of things that would help enable us to get there. There are probably some speakers that are following me that can maybe do a better job of answering that question for you.
Okay, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Thornton, I just have some concern that we're not looking at the outcome of what some would see as very laudable goals, but there are real impacts on individuals. Light trucks make up 35% of the transportation emissions in 2010. How do we get food to the grocery store if we have to cut out a significant amount of our transportation emissions? And so there are some very practical questions that I hope, with Senator Marty's permission, we'll answer over the course of the next 2 years. But I'd like to bring those issues forward as long as we're talking about the big picture. Real life is a big picture as well. So,
thank you, Mr. Thornton. Ms. Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is J. Drake Hamilton. I'm with Fresh Energy, and I spoke before the committee on Tuesday. So just a reminder, Fresh Energy is a science-based nonprofit organization that focuses on clean, efficient energy policies for Minnesota that will grow our energy market around saving consumers' dollars on energy, increasing energy efficiency investments, and really tapping into our renewable resources that can be locally produced in Minnesota. I've been asked to speak just for a few minutes as kind of a transition between the assistant commissioner and the deputy commissioner as one of the non-agency members of the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group. And I just wanted to let people know that of those 56 members, quite a few were business and nonprofit members, many of whom were not paid to serve on this one-plus year tour of duty. And many of the members were actually not in that set of 56, but in addition to that, there were dozens of other people who served and provided their technical expertise to the working groups that fed into this report. And I wanted to let the committee members know that from my perspective, when Fresh Energy decided to join the MCAG, we were invited by then-Governor Pawlenty, and we really liked the invitation the way it was framed because the charge was to get to at least 30% emission reductions by 2025, which is a big charge. And I liked the frame because the governor said we're going to look at the lowest cost, biggest impacts, so the biggest levers, the biggest levers that you can pull. And in fact, that's what we did, and we came up with a plan that at the time would allow Minnesota, according to modeling, to get to at least 30% reduction. What I also liked about the process was that when we stepped back at the end of it and looked at that list of policies and initiatives, I would say about half of them were about cutting waste and getting more efficient and in every sector. And in fact, what the assistant commissioner just said about the projections for transportation going down, that is mostly due to federal fuel economy standards that by the year 2025 are going to just about double fuel economy for light trucks, so you can have whatever size vehicle you need, but also do it more efficiently. And we found that in the waste sector and in energy as well. I would just suggest, and the assistant commissioner spoke of this, but I think it might be useful for the committee and for people in Minnesota who Will Steger and I found in our open Q&A period, many of the people were encouraged to learn that Minnesota has science-based greenhouse gas emission reduction goals. And the idea is to protect Minnesota from the projections of climate change that could mean anything from an additional 7 degrees Fahrenheit of warming in the waters of Lake Superior, which would turn Lake Superior from an oligotrophic lake unproductive to a blue-green algae lake in our lifetimes, and to protect against those things and to grow Minnesota's efficiency in renewable energy. So I would just suggest taking a look at from Mr. Kolash's slides. It's not numbered, but at the top of page 2, the trends so far, and the yellow segment that goes out to 2010, and Mr. Kolash explained why that is, that there's a data lag. And then there's that horizontal blue line, which is the 2015 goals. It would be great if in the next little while, as the agencies work on the suite of projections, if they could draw in a band of dotted lines. How are we doing? Are we going to meet that 2015 goal by 2015? Are we going to surpass it? Are we going to get shy of it? And then what do we need to do going forward? I think it's very important. 2015 is just a few years away, but to think in terms of the 2025 goals. And Fresh Energy encourages the committee and the legislature to look at having the state finally adopt a comprehensive, practical, workable plan that will actually grow the economy of Minnesota, save money, cut waste, and allow us to meet these goals going forward. We look back at that law that was passed in 2007 with strong bipartisan majorities, and we think that there is a workable plan going forward. There's a lot of new information, but there's a lot of new technology and new initiatives that we can plug into Minnesota and make Minnesota a leader, even more of a leader in efficiency and renewable energy. Thank you very much.
Senator Brown, then Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hamilton, I think I heard you correctly, but could you expound upon this? How is our regulation of greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota going to change our climate in Minnesota?
Thank you, Senator Brown, and members of the committee. It's global warming that we're talking about, and I think that's probably what you're referring to. So this is a global problem. We need not only Minnesota, but India and China and Europe and everyone to get on board. But I was encouraged when then-Governor Pawlenty started assembling this MCAG group, and he, I think, pretty astutely said, Minnesota does not bear all the responsibility for global warming, of course not, but we have our share of responsibility. And I know that that's a value that a lot of Minnesotans have, that if you have a responsibility, and if you're a pretty well-off country like ours is compared to many in the world, that maybe you can show the path forward. And in addition, when we're talking about these cleaner cars, cleaner sources of energy, better ways to heat and cool our homes, we're also talking about a suite of technological innovations that I know I hope will be innovations that are produced and sold from businesses in Minnesota to the rest of the world rather than vice versa. So not the whole, Senator, not the whole shebang, but doing our part and leading the way.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Hamilton, I understand that, but I thought I heard you say something about Lake Superior and algae in our lakes. I was wondering if you could expound upon that.
Oh, sure. Thank you for clarifying that, Senator Brown and members of the committee. About 10 days ago, 13 federal agencies, as required by 1990 law, issued their third national climate assessment, which is peer-reviewed science looking at projections of, under business as usual, what might happen to the climate in different regions of the country. And so they looked at, we're in part of the Midwest region, we're on the western end of the Midwest region. And then in addition, they're required to look at different sectors of the economy. So impacts on agriculture, impacts on lakes and water, impacts on forestry, impacts on human health and urban infrastructure. So I like that report because it's very practical. It's things that people really care about. What about my part of the country? And what about how I make a living? And one of those projections was that in addition to the warming that we've already seen in Lake Superior that's been documented by scientists up at UMD, which has all kinds of impacts, some negative and some positive, on freight transport through that lake, we're likely to see an additional 7 degrees Fahrenheit of warming in Lake Superior. And so what that would do is take a lake that is prized and iconic in Minnesota for being cold water lake, not very productive, and turn it into a more blue-green algae, toxic algae kind of lake. So it's something that people didn't really think would ever happen in our lifetimes, and it would have impacts on the beaches and the water quality. But here on land in Minnesota, we have seen so far, according to state climatologists, and you heard from Mark Seeley on Tuesday, northern Minnesota has warmed between 2 and 4 degrees Fahrenheit in the last 30 years. The projection for the next 38 years is an additional 5 degrees Fahrenheit warming in northern Minnesota. And so that is why Peter Reich was here to talk about prospective changes in the forest resource. And so I think about that as everything from recreation in Minnesota to, you know, really more important for our economy, how are people making their livings off that forest resource? What will the trees look like? What type of trees should we be planting for harvest in 30 years? And how will we need to morph that forest industry so that we can continue to have that prized economic resource, but be cognizant that things are changing?
Mr. Chair and Ms. Hamilton, my last question. Is how we regulate greenhouse gases in Minnesota going to change or slow down that projected temperature increase in Lake Superior?
Senator Brown, we're a small part of the world, and that's probably what you're getting at, and we're a relatively small part of the economy. But other economies, including the 8 states of the Northeast, California, and even now parts of China, which are looking at capping carbon and switching out some of their coal fleet and replacing the less efficient coal plants with more efficient coal plants. So that's part of the story that doesn't get reported. There are these changes that are occurring in other economies, and the idea is to start the ball rolling. I think there's a pretty good argument to be made for whatever economies, and I hope they include Minnesota, take the lead on developing these renewable energy and energy efficiency resources, as we have already started to do, that they will lead and drive that economy and produce even more of an export market for Minnesota. So I don't think there's any projection on the table for actually regulating carbon in Minnesota. That was not discussed at the MCAG. But instead, looking at the building blocks of how we can transform our energy system and our transportation system to lower carbon in a way that's going to grow industries in Minnesota. So not limiting the carbon, but instead saying, let's replace higher carbon with better alternatives, and let's do it in a market-friendly way. Best example, I think you'll hear later from Jim Nichols about the renewable energy standard in the state and how that has helped rural economies and has helped. I think Mr. Grant will be talking about how our switch to wind power in Minnesota has been part of the reason why we've been able to dip down in greenhouse gas emissions.
And Ms. Hamilton, when you were mentioning earlier about the jobs that come from it, a month ago, the German energy minister was in Minnesota, and he was talking about how Germany is the country that's probably been most aggressive in addressing this issue, and he said that they now have 400,000 people in their renewable energy efficiency economy, far more than they have in all their fossil fuel industry, which is in Germany's an old industrial power. He said many of their jobs were technology export, because they're the first ones into it. They're the ones who get the jobs. And I think that's one of the hopes, because as other states, we hope, are addressing these same things. If we're a step ahead of them, we get the jobs. If we're a step behind them, they get the jobs. And I think that's a big part of what you've got to be talking about.
Mr. Chairman, when I was listening to the assistant commissioner talk about the need to determine what is the plan going forward to reach the 2015 and 2025 goals, I hope that the state will be looking especially at how we maximize the number of well-paying jobs in doing that.
Senator Osmek.
Thank you, Chairman. Ms. Hamilton, I had a question. You brought up CAFE standards, and that Detroit / the auto industry is going to be increasing, basically doubling CAFE standards within the next 20 or so years. I'd like more information about that. Right now, the engines themselves are more efficient than ever. What additional steps are in the pipeline? I'm not familiar with this. What exactly is the auto industry looking at doing to improve that, short of reducing the size of their vehicle fleets? Or what other options are they taking into account that would produce or move towards that goal 20 years from now?
Thank you, Senator Osmond, Mr. Chairman. I'm probably not the very best person to address that specifically, but I want you to know that I think it was in late 2010, 2011, right after the auto bailout federally, there was, a great deal of public pressure on the president and the administration that, in addition to just giving money to bail out the big three auto manufacturers, that we needed to be getting something more in return, like better cars going forward, better cars of all sizes, so to meet the needs of real Americans going forward, which I think is really important. And so there was a deal that was worked out, and the auto manufacturers agreed that they could continue to meet those size segments of automobiles and light trucks and achieve almost a doubling in fuel economy standards going forward. So you might want to have some testimony from somebody who's better versed, perhaps somebody from the federal administration, to talk about about specifics of those technologies. But it was an historic movement, and it's something that has, I think, in Minnesota, but certainly nationwide, has been the biggest thing that this country has done so far to reduce carbon pollution. And what it's going to turn into is saving us lots of money in our gas tanks and fewer trips to the gas pump.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. Appreciate your testimony. Next, we're going to turn to Bill Grant from the Department of Commerce. And while he's sitting down, I'll mention to the committee, and we've got an overflowing committee attendance today, the committee handouts, we're trying to get them posted on the committee page. We still haven't gotten Senate tech people to do that, but they are available online. The committee can give you a link to where we've got them posted for now if people want to see them. Mr. Grant, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bill Grant for the Minnesota Department of Commerce Energy Division. I wanted to start, show me this indulgence, to give you my take on some of the recent numbers that we've seen contributing to a small but significant decline in greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota. And I think, and it's difficult to untangle all of this data, and so I don't want to attribute certainly all of the change that we've seen. And as Mr. Kolash pointed out, economic conditions were certainly one of the main drivers there. But at least in the electricity sector, I think there are some other things that we can point to. One is that the renewable energy standard that this body passed in 2007, at the time that it was passed, we were somewhere in the neighborhood of 1% of our energy coming from renewable energy sources. Today, as we sit here, we're at 12%, a significant ramp up in the amount of energy being contributed to the system, which is, you can't think of that as a one-for-one replacement for fossil fuel use, for coal-fired power. It isn't that. It's something less than that. But it certainly has had the effect of lowering emissions in the electricity sector. Second issue, also the subject of legislation in 2007, was the change from requiring utilities, both gas and electric, to meet a certain spending target as they offered energy efficiency programs for their customers to a savings target. And the net impact of that that we've seen is that that's increased the amount of savings that we've seen in those sectors by anywhere from 2 to 3 times. So we've taken a big step up in terms of the amount of efficiency across both the gas and electric sectors. And I think that that's certainly having an impact as well. Lower natural gas prices are certainly one of the factors that's contributing here. And we're already beginning to see gas substituting for coal in the Minnesota electricity markets. In the transportation sector, you've already heard that federal fuel efficiency standards have been a significant factor. But we've also seen a significant reduction in vehicle miles traveled. And so the combination of those two are part of the story here. And finally, even though it's clear that there are economic factors that are at play here, one of the things, and it's too soon yet to really be able to tease this out from the data that we're getting, but we're beginning to sense that there are at least some element of the total demand for energy that we're seeing that is representing a structural demand shift, a shift down in the amount of average use per capita, and that's across all of the energy using sectors. We think that that's largely a conservation response that we're seeing, and that as the economy tightened, people took actions that are going to have a long-term effect on their energy use. They purchased more efficient appliances, better furnaces, that sort of thing, and they altered some of their behavior. Which a behavioral change is more difficult to sustain, perhaps. And so it's too soon yet to say whether this structural demand shift that we think is out there will persist or not. I want to turn to the MKG report and to progress in the various areas since the report was released in 2008. And a lot of the things that I'll mention here are agency activities or other activities that haven't necessarily been done as a result of or in the name of meeting the state's climate protection goals, but that have been activities associated with the various recommendations that came out of the MKG report. And as we look now again to those recommendations and the areas where we might have new opportunities, it's important, I think, to understand that it's not as if nothing has been happening. Clearly, as Assistant Commissioner Thornton points out, we're not on a trajectory at this point to achieve our goals. And these sorts of activities and others would have to be ramped up significantly in order to do that. But it's not as if we haven't made a start. As Mr. Thornton mentioned, the residential, commercial, and industrial, really, when you if you think about that, that's the building sector of our economy, and it's one of the largest sources of energy use in the economy. And there have been a number of things going on here. We have, by state law, one of the tightest building energy codes in the country, and the Department of Labor and Industry is just now completing a rulemaking to upgrade those standards even further to make sure that it remains one of the tightest building energy codes in the country. We've been working on establishing green building guidelines in the public sector so that by 2030, we can meet the goal that this body set in 2008 of having all new public buildings be net energy zero buildings, and we're well on the way to establishing those guidelines. And it's already been mentioned, but the Conservation Improvement Program, which is the utility-sponsored programs that drive most of the energy efficiency that does occur in the state, has ramped up significantly as a result of the 2007 legislation. Turning to the energy supply sector, again, a number of things that have been going on here. With respect to existing power plants serving the state of Minnesota, the Public Utilities Commission, at the department's recommendation, has been conducting a series of what have been termed baseload diversification studies. If you think about it, the electric sector in Minnesota is dominated by coal-fired power. Somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters of our power plants are coal-fired, and I think by anyone's definition, that's not a well-balanced portfolio. And utilities have also realized that, and that it's not a good position for them to be in for a variety of reasons. It's not a good hedge against the price inflation on the price of coal, and it's certainly not a good hedge against the increasing amount of federal regulation of emissions of all kinds from those power plants. And so utilities have really begun looking at how they would diversify their own resource mix in order to be better balanced. And at the same time, that will have the effect of reducing carbon emissions from that sector. We've completed one analysis for Minnesota Power, and we're in the process of working through with them the status of several facilities on their system, whether they will continue to operate as coal-fired power plants, whether they will be converted to some other form of fuel, likely natural gas, or a combination of natural gas and wind power. The renewable energy standard, I've already mentioned that. We're about halfway there to the goal that you set in 2007, and the utilities are very much on schedule with the interim goals that you set with that legislation. So we can expect roughly a doubling of the amount of renewable energy from the electric sector over the course of the next 10 years or so. And finally, the department has been leading an effort on distributed generation. The reason that we have is that we've been hearing from an increasing number of customers that they want to be able to generate their own electricity at their homes or businesses. And yet the rules that we put in place some 30 years ago for how those interactions should work, both from a technical perspective, in other words, how those systems are physically interconnected to the grid, and also from an economic perspective, in other words, what people will be paid for the output from those systems, really is quite antiquated at this point. And we have been working with a group of stakeholders over the last year and a half to really dig into what those rules of the road are and whether they should be updated. And I'm hoping, Mr. Chairman, that will be a topic your committee will want
I
to take up.
I think we will. Distributed generation is a big enough part of the equation that at some point we'll be asking you to report on what you've been discussing with utilities and other stakeholders and so on.
And I'd be happy to do that, Mr. Chairman. Moving on to the other sectors that were covered by the MCAG process, Transportation and land use was a big area, and the Transportation Department reports that a number of the things that were suggested there have become part of their planning at the agency. For example, one of the proposals has come to be known as Complete Streets, and it was a proposal that really said that as we design city streets, streets in smaller towns across the state, that we should really be thinking multimodal. In other words, we want to be able to accommodate not only cars, but we want to be able to accommodate bicycles, pedestrians, transit to the extent that that makes sense in that particular location. And that really, that paradigm really has become very much a part of the Department of Transportation's planning. And so we have seen in a number of cases increases in the use of transit, obviously. The light rail lines that have been going forward, but also better infrastructure for bicycle and pedestrians to make use of the same rights of way that automobiles do. And finally, it's already been mentioned that the federal fuel efficiency standards have kind of preempted us, because there was one of the recommendations was to adopt what was then known as the California Clean Car Standard. And the feds actually beat us to that and did us a little bit better than the California standard required at the time. In the agriculture, forestry, and waste sections, again, a number of activities that have been occurring since the report was released in 2008. There's the work that's been done under the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy program, a number of reinvested Minnesota easements, all of which help fix soil carbon and have a number of other environmental benefits as well, but certainly contribute to carbon reductions. There's been a fair amount of work on biomass to energy projects, and the Next Generation Energy Board has released a number of grants to projects from entrepreneurs around Minnesota to demonstrate those technologies. And we've put a lot of acres under easement in forests through the Minnesota Forest for the Future program. Just a couple of others. In waste policy, the Pollution Control Agency led a stakeholder process in 2009, I think really focusing on consumer rates of recycling and ways to improve those rates. And some of those recommendations are now being implemented. And one sector of the MCAG process dealt with what were called cross-cutting issues, in other words, things that cut across all of the different areas of the economy. And just one of the things that's gone forward from that has been work out of the DNR State Climatology Office, really documenting the trends in long-term temperature, precipitation, humidity, and stream flow, so that we can really have an ongoing record of the changes that we're seeing on the landscape and the effects that they're having. So because, as Assistant Commissioner Thornton mentioned, a lot of the information that was assembled in 2007, 2008, would now be considered less than reliable for the purposes of your policymaking, we've assembled a team, an interagency team across state government, to identify additional opportunities and those things that might be immediate opportunities for this body to consider, and also those areas that are going to require longer-term study and analysis to determine, A, what is the greenhouse gas reduction potential associated with them, and what are the costs associated with implementing those recommendations, and what are the things that we would move forward with today with better information that we have available to us now. So as you can see, we've assembled a team that includes my agency, Pollution Control, Natural Resources, Transportation, Agriculture, Admin, and Department of Labor and Industry, and the group has had a couple of meetings now and planning to meet again next week. We're trying to fast-track this as much as possible, Mr. Chairman, so that, again, if anything does emerge as low-hanging fruit for early action, that we can provide you with that information just as soon as possible.
Thank you. And Mr. Grant, as the legislature, if we take a look at a strategy to get to the goal, since it's one thing we had the MCAG report, but no ongoing strategy, this is the interagency team that we would be dealing with.
That's right.
Are there questions from members of the committee? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Grant, on an earlier slide, you talked about baseload diversification studies. And I'm just wondering, what are some of our diversified options for baseload power if coal sees a significant reduction?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Brown, the option that is coming to the fore as we look at this, obviously we have natural gas as an option. Typically, when we build natural gas plants, we build them as peaking facilities, not as baseload facilities. And so what we're finding is that if you combine a certain amount of natural gas-fired capacity with a certain amount of wind energy to fill out the energy that the turbine isn't providing in non-peak hours, that you can mimic what a baseload facility would provide fairly closely and provide the same sort of energy, at least from the system's perspective, what it sees coming onto the system. And that's clearly one of the options that seems to be quite viable.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Grant, are there other options? I mean, that's two. That's not real diversified, but are there other options?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Brown, certainly there are. And biomass options are certainly available in some parts of the state where particularly in northern Minnesota, where we have good access to logging slash and other biomass from other activities. Energy conservation certainly is one of the options that utilities, I think, are looking to more strongly than before. And as we, I think, move forward in the area of distributed generation, as I hope we will, I think that there's a fair amount of contribution to base load power that can come from certain renewable technologies, particularly solar.
Senator Dibble, then Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Grant actually answered the question mostly that I was going to ask, but I would also just throw in the mix hydropower.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble. Yes, as a matter of fact, I'm glad you mentioned that because we are looking now, and utilities are looking at increasing the share of power that we're importing from Canada, from hydro facilities in Canada, and there will be a discussion soon about new power line facilities to accommodate those purchases. Well,
Mr. Chair, just follow up. But I also understand, Mr. Chair and Mr. Grant, with new turbine technology, we're able to get bigger bang for the buck, more generation from smaller turbines, smaller facilities located closer to home.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble, that is absolutely correct. The amount of hydro capacity in Minnesota is fixed to some extent, but repowering of existing facilities with improved turbines can certainly enhance the amount of capacity, and that is 24/7 baseload capacity. So,
and as you at least hinted in your answer, the energy efficiency is probably the cheapest way to replace baseload power.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner Grant, perhaps we could have, and Mr. Chair, we could have a little review of what type of projects are being funded through the NextGen board. I've sat on that board for probably 6-8 years. I can't remember now. And there's some fascinating projects that are being funded that do have great potential, and it would be nice to have a review on that.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rosen, we'd be happy to do that. I think it probably best come from the Department of Agriculture because Commissioner Fredrickson is chairing that body, and his staff, I'm sure, would be happy to provide an update on projects that have been funded and the status of those.
Yeah. Further questions from the committee? If not, thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now we're going to turn a little bit more to some of the impacts. I know the House had a hearing, I believe, this morning or today on impacts and mitigation of climate impacts, but we want to have Ms. Brummer about environmental health issues related to this. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Linda Brummer, Division of Environmental Health Director from the Minnesota Department of Health. And I guess I don't know if my slides are on here.
We do have packets of
You
them
do have packets.
Least, so.
I can talk without
Go
the
ahead,
slides. That's
we'll
okay.
See if we can get the machine.
Just don't like to touch other people's computers. Yeah. The first slide that I have is the handout. Well, first there's my introduction. But the one I want to talk about is our logic model that you have in color. And this is the way we frame climate change at the health department and look at health outcomes. So what you know from the previous testimony is Minnesota has experienced changes in climate, including an increase in average temperature, increasing humidity, and a change in the quantity and character of precipitation that can cause both increased flooding and drought. So in the first side, you see observed climate changes. Then what we look at next are what are the likely events that will happen because of these climate changes. We look at extreme heat events, which will then lead to heat-related illnesses and deaths. We also look at one of the issues is possibly a longer growing season, which may be good in some sectors of the economy, but for those of you who suffer from allergies, not so good sometimes. It will mean pollen will be in the air for a longer period of time. We also look at increased flooding, which causes injuries, infrastructure damage, mental health issues, and displacement. So the last column are these possible health outcomes. And so at the health department, we're trying to do preventive work in advance. We've put together some toolkits to help local public health deal with these problems, and we've also been tracking them. We have an environmental public health tracking program that is looking at the science, the ecological and climatological data, and then looking at are there health trends that are paralleling those climatological events. One of the things I want to talk about, though, too, this has put increased pressure on our emergency response activities at the health department. The Duluth flood event most recently, we sent mental health professionals to each of the disaster recovery centers to help work with people who were showing up looking for assistance. This is a newer part of the health department's work in emergency preparedness and has been highly valued. So moving on to the next slide, I'll look at the distribution of Lyme disease cases by county of residence, and this is 1996 to 2010. As you can see, the incident rate has increased during this time. The physical and biological conditions that we see connected with climate change can impact the abundance and distribution of ticks, the percent of ticks that are infected with disease agents, the abundance and distribution of animals that carry ticks, the presence and suitable habitat for ticks, and people's behaviors that bring them into contact with infected ticks. So think about if you don't have air conditioning in your home and you think, well, I'll take a nice walk in the woods or in the pasture, you might end up encountering more ticks than you might have if you had air conditioning at home. Just that's how your behavior can be affected by the difference in climate change. Anecdotally, at the health department, we used to, as of the year 2000, we only had safety training for our inspectors in the field in the Fergus Falls and Bemidji district offices for Lyme disease. That was the, tuck your pants into your socks and make sure you have long sleeves on and check yourself for ticks. And I think if you look at the incidents, you certainly would agree that we pretty much offer that training statewide now for our staff. The health department's tick-borne disease monitoring system is able to detect this increase in the number of people contracting Lyme disease and the change in the geographic distribution of high-risk areas. Health Department has developed prevention strategies, including educational messages for the public on where and how and when they are at risk and how to protect themselves. However, we don't know how fast Lyme disease or other tick-borne disease will spread and how much of the spread is related to climate change. We also do not have adequate resources to perform field studies for new or emerging diseases that may be carried by ticks. That requires collecting tick samples out in the field. You might have seen it similar to collecting butterflies. You go through, you walk through a pasture with a net and sweep and then see what you've captured. So Lyme disease and other tick-borne disease cases are increasing and being reported, and the climate variability appears to be related to that different, the change in tick cases. Next graph is it's a case study in emergency department visits, so it's extreme heat. Emergency department visits, what it is a graph on the left-hand side is average summer temperature in Fahrenheit. Thank you very much. So what we've got is on the left-hand side of the graph, average summer temperature. And the top line, the red line, is that temperature line from 2000 to 2010. And then the blue line is an age-adjusted rate of emergency department visits that related to heat-related illness. And so as you see, there appears to be a correlation on this graph. And I'll tell you specifically what happened in 2012. One of the reasons I need to explain that the data for this graph are only back to 2010. As you can imagine, it takes us a while to collect information after an event like this has happened. We don't have instantaneous reporting on this. Often the newspapers will call us up and ask how many deaths have been reported because of the extreme heat. Well, as you can imagine, that requires going through death records, actually, to see what the cause of death was. So we don't have that sort of information available in the state. What we choose to do instead is work actively with local public health and come up with recommendations as to what people can do while it's hot. So we haven't focused yet. We've talked. We've got a committee meeting on this sort of health data. We've talked about possibly standardizing reporting. Can we make sure the EMS folks report, the emergency response people report in certain codes so we could grab that data more quickly? But so we're working on that piece right now, talking to people. So in July of 2012, that was the second warmest July on record in the Twin Cities. On the 4th of July, the temperature hit 101 and the record dew point was 77. Temperatures continued to stay in the upper 90s and hundreds for several days, reaching a record high of 102 on July 6th. The Minneapolis Department of Health responded to the extreme heat by implementing their heat annex plan. Many cities and counties don't have a heat response plan, but we have developed a toolkit and have been working with more local public health groups to be ready. The health department provided information on open public sites, on what public sites were open so people could visit. These are frequently called the cooling centers. Ensured that the radio and TV provided tips on how to stay cool, including messages that you might remember on visiting older neighbors to make sure they were cool, make sure, you know, if they didn't have air conditioning, to check on them. The Minneapolis Health Department used maps created by the Health Department. We have a GIS system where we've used demographic data to try and predict where the at-risk people will be. And so we looked at screens such as children under 5, older folks over 65, looked at income levels. Lower income levels would tend not to have air conditioning. And it's a series of about 5 different maps that I could show you at the state level, but it's more interesting at the local level. You can drill down and get the local level data to see where you might predict that you need to focus. I know in some neighborhoods, some places, they've actually gone door to door in neighborhoods just to make sure people were okay. So the Minneapolis Department of Health did conduct ad hoc monitoring to determine how many people were affected by the health department, or by the heat, I'm sorry. The department checked in one or more times daily with city fire, police, their information hotline, Hennepin County Medical Center, North Memorial, and the 911 call center. So that was the best data that were available at the time. As I said, Health Department has developed a toolkit for planning for these extreme heat events to help local public health and emergency managers and the mapping services that I mentioned. So with that, it's a fairly small program within my division, but we've been fairly successful to put a lot of tools together. We've worked with the first under planning. SHAC is the State Community Health State Advisory Committee. Climate Change Adaptation Work Group, we've done vulnerability mapping, and the toolkits are available. We've done some of the research you've seen on the graphs. And the most important part is the education. We've developed a module, training modules, that we hope we're at the tail end of a 3-year grant from the Centers for Disease Control. It runs out in August, and we are hoping to apply for an implementation grant to follow up and continue this work at the Health Department.
Thank you, Ms. Brummer. You mentioned this. I was trying to figure out what the acronym SCHSAC, the State Community Health State Advisory Committee or something you said?
State and, yes, Mr. Chair.
Well, is they?
State twice.
So they actually have a group that is looking at these, because I was going to say, when you mentioned the Lyme disease, we've been hearing from people talking about new terrestrial invasive species. I mean, ticks are only one of them. I keep thinking how many bugs we see we didn't have 20 years ago and so on. This group is meeting regularly. This community health, the public health agencies around the state have a task force that's looking at whether it's extreme heat or new species or other risks related to this?
Mr. Chair, that group has been meeting more on what things we need to do to adapt to climate change. So we do have entomologists at the Health Department. Perhaps you've heard from David Neitzel from time to time, who certainly could come in and talk to you about what new bugs we're seeing. Those are his graphs on Lyme disease.
I was not asking so much what we could have, just curious. There is somebody at Health Department working with public health agencies in terms of what the new risks, new threats, and new responses need to be in effect.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Questions from committee? Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple questions on your slide regarding the heat emergency room visits. You're saying here that these are directly heat related. Is that the primary diagnosis that's indicated, or are you looking at all of this, the secondary or comorbidities, when you're saying that these are heat related?
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmond, the way this graph has been explained to me is that they have culled out the heat-related illness, so that is the primary reason why the people are coming to the emergency room. So it'd be as if you took, the average number of visits to an emergency room and took out, all the heart attacks that you normally see, I work for the health department. I'm sorry.
And I work for the insurance company, so I'm very familiar with it.
So these have been called out for the primary reason was heat-related, yes.
Okay,
and
so,
I can connect you
so the primary folks. Diagnosis starts as heat-related, and the secondaries are all comorbidities to the primary.
Yes.
Okay. And then one additional question, Mr. Chairman. Regarding your comparisons of the heat related numbers, the same graph. Do you have any? Does the department have any information regarding back in the 1930s regarding how many heat related per 100,000 adjusted emergency room visits were back in the 1930s when we had an incredible wave of heat compared to what we're seeing at this in the past decade?
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmak, I'll check. I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay, thank you.
I'm guessing while those were terrible years, we probably don't have a lot of records, and a lot of people just...
That would be my guess, but I'll check.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Commissioner. Any further questions from the committee? If not, former Commissioner Nichols, welcome back to the Minnesota Senate.
Thank you,
Haven't
Mr.
seen
Chairman.
You for a long time.
I know. Paige, I have some handouts.
We will get them distributed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a privilege to be back here in this committee room. For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Jim Nichols. I have farmed my entire life in southwest Minnesota, and this testimony is mine. I speak only for myself, but I am a member of Minnesota 350 and Minnesota Fresh Energy. Talking quickly about the economic impact, and as the page hands this out, I'll say the Next Generation Act, a lot more can be done. And for anyone who doubts whether we can get to the 25% and that law, 25 by 25, and it's nice that Aaron Peterson, the House author of that bill, is here. That was a great law, and I want to talk about what it's done for rural Minnesota. And a couple of months ago, 25% of all the energy produced in the Midwest was produced from wind energy. And this is from MISO, which controls all of the power lines in the Midwest. 10,000 megawatts, that's 10 billion watts of electricity, were produced from wind in November. More importantly, members, that moved down the transmission line to the big cities where it was needed, and it was consumed by the people who needed it. When you're in the wind business, and we are in rural Minnesota, 5 turbines could supply all of Lincoln County. We have 300 turbines there, so we got to transport it where it's needed to the big cities. And when people come to our wind turbine, and I've been privileged to host 30 members of Congress. I've testified before Congress. I've testified in a dozen state legislatures, and all of them, the question is the same. How did you accomplish this? It's a privilege to be here with so many people that worked on the law in 1991 that required oxygenated fuels, the law in 1994 that required wind energy, and the law again in 2007 that went to 25 by 25, and now the Next Generation Act. So to get to 25%, you don't need to question whether or not we can do it. We've already done it. Now we need to do it on a more consistent basis. Now, if you have before you those handouts, do you have them now,
yes,
Mr. Chairman?
Have them now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the very first one, and I'll talk quickly here because I know I got to stay on schedule. This power line is the CapEx 2020 line, again, initiative by this legislature, and this legislature has done so many great things. Your leadership, thank you. That line runs 238 miles. It connects on this end to the Prairie Island plant, 345,000-volt plant. Goes out to just across the Minnesota line to Brookings, South Dakota, which is 300 megawatts of natural gas peaking, to answer Senator Benson's question. We well know that the wind doesn't blow all the time, so it's nice to link wind turbines, which produce no pollution, with the nuclear plant, which doesn't produce any pollution, and those natural gas plants that produce a relatively small amount of pollution, Mr. Chairman. So that line is a tremendous accomplishment, and it will move 1,200 megawatts. That will light up 400,000 homes. And what I want to point out is, as you can see, there are 12 wires on these poles, and we do transmission a lot differently now. I've always argued that we have the corridors already. We've got 1 million miles of roads, and every road has 2 ditches. And it's all owned by the public. And those road ditches are the perfect spot for a transmission line. We no longer build those great big towers. And I was here in the 70s when that was awful, when people were getting killed because of that line. We don't do that anymore. These lines go right down county roads and township roads. And Great River Energy and Randy and Craig, the project managers, have done a great job. They stay on roads that do not have a lot of traffic. You avoid all the towns. If there's a house there, they jog over to the other side of the road. And more importantly, 12 wires on a single pole, Mr. Chairman. 1,200 megawatts. It's incredible. Now, very quickly, I just, for your information, you know, I read a lot of articles about the tax breaks, as you can see here. And this is from the Congressional Research Service. The oil industry gets $76 billion, and that's over a 10-year period. Congress only calculates in 10-year periods because they don't do anything from year to year, you know, so they got to
group stuff together and look like they've actually done something. But anyhow, you know, there's a lot of debate about tax breaks. Well, this is the oil industry tax breaks, and we don't even talk about the fact that most of their good oil is on public lands. And I'll never forget, I was so angry. Someone from the Bureau of Land Management had said he screwed up on the contract, made a mistake on the easement, cost the taxpayers, you know, the landholders, $10 billion. Guy just didn't happen to notice he'd made a $10 billion mistake. Now, Mr. Chairman, to get here, this next one about the wind tax credit, and again, members of the committee, Congress did pass it. It's really for another 2 years, because if you're in construction in 2013, it goes over to 2014. The problem with these tax breaks is Congress generally passes them for 2 years at a time. That just happens to link up with the fact that they're elected every 2 years, and the money that they get is incredible. And if they don't bring in enough money for their campaign coffers, they don't pass it. And then when they get enough money, they make it retroactive. So thank God it goes on for 2 years, because you just can't do it, Mr. Chairman, in 1 year. Now, look at all these projects there, as you can see, that are in line to be built. These are already permitted by the state of Minnesota. 1,200 megawatts is $1.2 billion of new investment in this state. That's what we could get here, but we need a little more push from the state legislature to get all of these done. And we need to seize on the fact that this tax credit is in place. Now, this tax credit, I know, is going to cost $1.2 billion a year for the next 10 years, so it's $12 billion. I'm not going to tell you that it's free, because it isn't, but it's less than the oil companies get. So with that, Mr. Chairman, number three here, this is this is our contract. We built a big wind turbine on my farm. I own it with my brother. It cost $1.5 million. Borrowed the money from Bremer Bank. It's not a hard loan to get. They're good loans, and I always tell my banker, what's $1 million among friends? And so far, we're still friends. Never missed a payment. You don't get rich owning a wind turbine, but on a good wind month, it's a nice little check, you know. And on a poor wind month, well, we've always made the debt service. But more importantly, look at the price here. 3.35 cents, locked for 25 years. And I give XL Energy a lot of credit on this. And some people criticize Minn Kota and some other people, Great River Energy, for what they've done. The reason the utilities were smart enough to step up to the plate is because they could lock the price in for 20 and 25 years. There aren't any contracts less than 20 years. So it's not just that this is cheap energy today, Mr. Chairman. Think how cheap it's going to be 25 years from now. And the utilities could see this coming. XL Energy is the largest buyer of wind energy in the United States. We've got that right here in Minnesota. More importantly, all my electricity comes from Lion Lincoln Electric Co-op. I'm a rural co-op member, and I believe in co-ops. I'm as a farmer my whole life. But they've raised their rates 3 times in the last 5 years, and I just got a newsletter 2 days ago. They're going to raise them again. My rate now at Lion Lincoln is 9.8 cents, and it's going to go over 10 cents. Now, they brought in a speaker at our annual meeting this year to badmouth wind energy. Well, if coal is so great, why are you charging me over 10 cents? Because all of our energy comes from the coal fields in North Dakota. It's exactly where it comes from. And XL Energy, I think, is at 8.6 now. I know they got an increase coming in. But the largest buyer of wind energy in Minnesota sells it cheaper than my co-op that buys only coal. So we need to look at the economics there, Mr. Chairman. Now, back to the economic impact. What you've done here as a legislature has changed the world where I live. We have 300 wind turbines in my county. We have almost 3,000 wind turbines in Minnesota. Now, in the beginning, some of those were pretty small. Now they're 1.5 to 2 megawatt turbines, but it's nearly 3,000, producing almost 3,000 megawatts of electricity. It's literally the economic impact is incredible. We have jobs for our kids now. They work on wind energy. My county gets $1 million in property taxes in a county with a $3 million budget from the wind turbines. And it goes to the county and the school district and the township. That's what it's done for us, Mr. Chairman, and I want to talk a little bit more about what it does for us as farmers. But if you look at, we now generate $7.6 million in property taxes from the wind turbines. And this legislature, it's a production tax. Because I came back here and I was a member of the tax committee, Turned out the wind turbine company are pretty smart. They accelerate to the depreciation. So after 5 years, they say, well, this depreciation, you can't tax it. Heck, it's worth nothing now. Now it's a production tax. And I've encouraged every state that I've testified before, all 12 states where I've been in the state capitol in front of the legislature, to pass Minnesota's laws requiring wind and oxygenated fuel and to adopt Minnesota's production tax. And actually, the wind companies don't object because it's a small part of what they actually produce. If you're a wind company, you never for sure know what you're going to pay in property taxes from the local school district. What if they pass a bond issue? But now it's tied to what you produce. It's much more fair. More importantly, Mr. Chairman, it'll go on, well, I say for at least 40 years, and that's the turbines we've built now. Our current turbines, we built them in first ones in 1994. Governor Carlson came to our dedication. What a great day in Lake Benton. They've been running 19 years now. All 73 have been running till a year and a half ago. Three don't run anymore. We had a tornado. We had 100-mile-an-hour winds in Lincoln County a year and a half ago. Took down all the power lines. Didn't our turbine, you know, I've been climbing and working on wind turbines for a lot of years. That's what I do in my other life, just kind of as a hobby. Those turbines are so tough, we've survived 180-mile-an-hour winds in Texas. You can't knock them down. But three turbines, two got their blades torn off. It was 165 miles an hour. The tornado hit three turbines. So of the first 73, three are not running right now. And one of them would keep the tower over. In the wind business, we believe you can't knock it over. But they're going to save that one because they want to see that it really can happen. You can actually, with strong enough wind, knock it over. Those wind turbines can ride out just incredible storms, Mr. Chairman. And now, this is kind of the most important thing I have to say. This map here that you see before you, you would turn to that map, because this is important. This is always my message to Congress. And you can see the calculation at the bottom. We have struck oil. We have struck oil. And I cannot say that strong enough. The average, we now produce, the average oil well in America produces 10.3 barrels of oil per day. And you can see the calculation there. There's 5.8 million BTUs in a barrel of oil. So it's 58 million BTUs per day. A 2-megawatt wind turbine at 40% capacity, and our turbine runs at 42%, but, you know, we can't say 100% because the wind doesn't blow all the time. At 40% capacity is what that's our standard in the industry now, produces 68 million BTUs of energy. A wind turbine produces more energy than an oil well. I cannot emphasize that enough. And my message to Congress when I was there, what I really like about the oil well on my farm, it will never run dry. Never run dry. It'll be here for my kids and my grandkids and my great-grandkids. As close as we can tell, the wind was blowing like this when the glacier entered here 12,000 years ago, so we'd like to think we're going to have another 12,000 years of wind. Think of an oil well that'll run for the next 12,000 years. It's absolutely incredible. And more importantly, look how cheap it is, 3.35 cents per kilowatt hour. And most importantly at all, we get to take the wind. I call it my combine in the sky. It's a wind harvester. Take the wind, instantly convert it to electricity, and transport it at the speed of light to all of my customers, which are in Minneapolis and St. Paul. As a farmer, I don't have a lot of crops that I can deliver at the speed of light. And usually I'm sleeping when it happens. When I get up in the morning, I run to my computer to see how much money I made last night, you know? Really, it's incredible. And then my plea to you is, if we don't do more, every day that the wind's blowing, you've lost that energy forever. You can chase that wind as far as you want, but you're not going to catch it. So every day we don't drill our oil wells, and I say you got to drill into the sky, put up one of those combines in the sky, you've lost that energy forever. And when I talk about the taxes that we get, you know, over a 40-year period, we're getting $7.6 million a year now, property taxes, in 40 years. And those turbines are going to run for 40 years. They've already been running for almost 20. That's $30 million in property tax income. If we doubled that, it would be $60 million if you do more. The farmers, we're getting now $8 million a year in payments from the wind turbines, $32 million over 40 years. You know, we'll take it. So that's what I want to emphasize. We have struck oil, members, and please, we got to drill more oil wells. We got 500,000 oil wells in America. We got about 38,000 wind turbines. We need to get to another 500,000 oil wells, make them wind turbines. Now, I got to talk quickly here. Number one builder of wind energy in America is Mortenson Construction. And a couple of years ago, they were building the wind turbines right beside my farm. Our turbine's been running for 8 years now. I watched Mortensen build, and when I worked on wind turbines, we'd do one a day. I've watched that crew do three turbines in one day. Same crew, same crane, three turbines in one day. I watched them do it. I was out combining corn and watched them do it. I've been told that they did six turbines in one day on the Prairie Rose project that just came online down by Laverne. I really find that hard to believe. But those guys are good. I mean, they can flat out put up a wind turbine, Mr. Chairman. It's impressive. Now, the next one, and this is right here in Eden Prairie, this here sheet. General Electric, and I give a lot of credit to this woman. I've never been there. But now they see a future in leasing electric cars because the fuel is so much cheaper. And, you know, let me put that in perspective. My rates at REA have gone up. When I testified before Congress a couple years ago, bought my plane ticket and bought my gas to get out to Washington. And on that day, gas was selling for $3.60 a gallon. And I drive, you know, I'm a farmer, so I'm not a hog or anything, but I got to have a four-wheel drive pickup. You can understand that, you know. I mean, and every year I pull one wagon to town so I got a witness that I can write it off on my taxes so that I say it's a farm truck. Gets 15 miles to the gallon. So 60 miles to the airport. But anyhow, to go 30 miles takes me two gallons of gas. So it's $7.20 it takes me to drive 30 miles. Today it's a little bit less because gas is $3.20. Well, back then my electric rates at REA were 7.2 cents. Takes 10 hours to charge up your car. 10 hours at 1,000 watts an hour. It's a kilowatt. You know, I always say on my turbine, I have to produce our turbine. I own it with my brother Kelly. I want to emphasize that. Got to light up 10 light bulbs for 1 hour, 1,000 watts for 1 hour to get 3.3 cents. That's how it works. And when you buy your electricity, you're buying it by the kilowatt hour. So in 10 hours, you get a full charge. That would cost, at 7.2 cents a kilowatt hour, it costs 72 cents to charge up an electric car. Well, and it goes 30 miles. Well, I had driven 30 miles, it's been $7.20. So my plea to Congress, my plea to you is, I really don't care if you care about the environment, if you don't care about anything, but for God's sakes, care about the consumers, are also taxpayers. You can cut my bill by 90%. We got to do this. We owe that to our kids, Mr. Chairman. So, real quickly, you had a question, Senator?
Thank you, Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your enthusiasm and energy. I want to ask you about an article that I read in the Minnesota State News. It's dated April 28, 2012, by Tom Stewart. I'd like to know your reaction. Let me read two paragraphs for you, and I'd like to know what you have to say about this. The Public Utilities Commission directed electric co-ops and utilities to report cost to ratepayers for complying with the RES. The three top win loss leaders in 2011 were Great River Energy, $35 million, Mincata, $27.5 million, Dairyland Power, $13.1 million in Minnesota and Wisconsin combined. That's a steep increase from 2012 when Great River Energy reported a $22 million loss in wind energy sales, while Mincata reported a $28.2 million loss the previous year. And then the next paragraph goes on to state, until market prices increase, Great River Energy will likely see continued negative effects of RES compliance. Great River and its 28 cooperatives urge officials to weigh the impact of further costs when considering additional regulations related to renewable energy so that the rates remain affordable. I guess I'd just like to know your reaction when I'm reading articles that are talking almost completely diametrically opposed to what you're talking about. And they're saying that these are lost leaders that are eventually going to be driving costs.
Well, first of all, I have a power contract for 3.35 cents. More importantly, the four letters that I've gotten, and I got them right here from my REA co-op, they had to raise the rates because the cost of coal went up in North Dakota. It all comes from the lignite fields in North Dakota. I know that contracts are being offered out there for 3.9 cents now. A lot of these projects that I showed you there, they would be around 3.9 cents per kilowatt hour. My REA, 2 years ago at the annual meeting, I went there because they said, you know, we can't afford wind energy. I said, well, look at the price. This is what we get, but I know you can get a contract for 3.9 cents. How much do you want? And according to your annual report, and I had it there with me, I said, you're paying 4.8 cents. So you come in here and you badmouth wind energy, but you're buying it for 4.8. You could buy it in the county for 3.9. Why don't you do this? And as an REA co-op, why don't you care about your members, who happens to be us? We're the guys that got to pay the bill, and we're farmers. And every wind turbine, I know we should do better. I saw it on the farmers were using too much too much emissions, but every one of our 3,000 wind turbines are on farmland. So I don't know, Senator, I read that article just like you, but I know exactly what's happening in my REA co-op, what they could buy it for from wind, and what they're now paying. That doesn't even, the numbers don't add up.
Well, Mr. Chairman, so you understand why I'm confused.
Yeah.
That I've got three energy producers saying this is a loss leader, this is costing money, which invariably is going to lead to higher energy prices as a result. But now you're saying something completely different. I'm confused.
Well, first of all, and thank you, because the price of wind energy has come down dramatically. One of the reasons is we don't build the turbines. They're not made. They're manufactured here, and in ours are required that blades and the towers come right here locally. But everything else, gearboxes, generating stuff, is made in Europe. So when a lot of these projects were built a few years ago, and you're exactly right, the cost of wind energy was more expensive. One of the big reasons is because of the euro dollar. You know, our Congress will not balance their budget. You know, we ought to throw everyone out as far as I'm concerned. But anyhow, our dollar is so weak that it costs 40% more to buy a wind turbine from Europe, and that's where they come from. Just in the dollar exchange rate. So we were getting killed by the debt of our own country, and the costs then were higher. But today, those costs are dramatically, first of all, the dollar is much more in balance, and second, the cost of the turbines have come down. The technology has improved dramatically. Just when we first started building, they were 330,000 watts. Today, they're 2 million watts. They've grown dramatically. We didn't know what we were doing when we passed this law in 94. So the cost has come down, Senator, it really has. But there was a time when they paid too much, and I know Minn Kota got caught in that.
Right, and Mr. Chairman, I'm just saying this is numbers from 2011. This isn't way back in ancient history. It's the numbers that they're reporting are very fresh. So I appreciate your position.
But it's
turbines that really
these contracts they signed a few years ago before that. It's costing them money because they were a little more expensive.
Okay.
And the price of coal keeps going up. This is my point. The beauty of wind is it's all debt service. The fuel is free. Good Lord's trying to help us out here. But thank you.
And I think on that issue, we will be bringing in lots of people from various utilities and others from the departments to talk about those issues, about rates in the future as well. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just really quickly, and then I'll finish.
Go ahead. Yes. And then we get a couple.
Okay, that other one, I've already talked about the 120 miles per gallon and what it would save in cost. But then the next one, and this is my plea to you, and then I got one last final plea. This is Beijing. I've been to Beijing more than once. Choking on their own pollution there. When I was there 25 years ago, they were mostly on bicycles. Well, they got tired of pedaling, you know. And they got some money now. Most of it's our money, so I can't blame them for that. But this is my plea to you. We get a lot of criticism of ethanol. Back in the 80s, Minnesota and St. Paul were polluted cities, and pretty severely polluted. I can remember Governor Purvich and I going down and standing in front of that EPA monitor down here in University in Snelling, and the red light was on, the alarms were going off because we were a polluted city. The scientists said there's only one way to clean this up. It's too much nitrous oxide and volatile organic compounds. You got smog. You got to make the gas burn cleaner. I mean, you know, this gas, we might think of it as great stuff, but three of the most potent carcinogens known to man are toluene, xylene, and benzene, and we're breathing that every day. More importantly, it just won't burn clean. So you have to add oxygen to the fuel. That's how we cleaned it up. And our law does not say ethanol, and there's one who helped draft that, and Senator Dave Fredrickson was the author here. It says oxygenate. Now, we wrote the law so that nothing else would qualify, but, I mean, that's what you do as smart legislators. Well, I know you do, and it's good that you do that stuff. I mean, we got to be smart here. But anyhow, so oxygenated fuel, we cleaned up Minneapolis and St. Paul in 1 year, but where we really helped was the city of Denver. You know, that it was always smog there. It's a beautiful city, but in the winter, it can't escape. Los Angeles. Now, the California Air Resources Board, they didn't like corn farmers because we're subsidized by the government. You know, and it's only several thousand dollars. Well, maybe $200,000 or something for the big farmers. You know, we're on welfare out there as farmers. You'd think they'd eliminate it pretty soon, but they don't. Once again, they've continued our welfare checks for another year in the latest farm bill. But anyhow, they put in MTBE. Well, MTBE is the oil company product. It's 40% oxygen. Ethanol is 60% oxygen, and that's the one thing I want to say. 60%. You have to add oxygen to clean up your pollution. If you try and buy pure oxygen, it's expensive, and it doesn't mix real well. You can put a turbocharger on your car, but you still don't get enough oxygen into the cylinder. So we put in an oxygenated fuel. And now, Mr. Chairman, think about this. We now produce 1.2 billion gallons of fuel in our own state. And we used to use, and I don't know what it is now, Bill, but it was 2.4 billion back then. We're getting better, I think. Bill's nodding his head. I don't know where we're at. But half of the fuel we consume, we now produce here. Our goal back then is we got to produce some of our own energy. And we didn't have any oil. You know, we're not in North Dakota. But we do that. Half of our own fuel. If we got totally cut off, we'd have to cut back our mileage some, but we could survive. We produce that here. We produce the wind energy here. So that's what we did. So my last thing, the Next Generation Energy Act, you can see by the state agencies, we're not quite keeping up where we should. And we're going to keep slipping back further and further. As a member of the committees, when a bill would come across the committee where I was a member, and we had these nice goals, so this is my standard amendment. Strike may and insert shall. It's a very simple amendment. Strike may and insert shall. If we had not passed a law that said we shall use oxygenated fuel, we shall use wind energy, where I live, we were the poorest county in the state in Lincoln County. Now we're doing quite well, thank you. We got all those wind turbines. And we had jobs for our kids, 50 jobs for our kids right out there now. 50 kids going to Cambia Vocational School to learn to be wind turbine technicians. We have a future now. And I know we're the biggest beneficiaries out there on the Buffalo Ridge, but there's huge amounts of manufacturers of wind turbine parts right here in the Twin Cities. Morton Construction, the biggest builder. Everybody has benefited, and we have reduced the emissions, as you can see, Mr. Chairman, largely because of the laws of 91 and 94 and 2007. But they did not say may they sell. They said shall. So that's my plea to you. It's an easy amendment, you know. Strike may, insert shall. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner Nichols. Always entertaining. Senator Rosen. Thank you. Senator Rosen and Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good to see you, Commissioner Nichols. I live in the land of wind and ethanol and hogs.
Yes, I know you do.
Yes, okay. So very much.
Your family, great people.
Yeah, they're good people and very much ag-based. But
yes,
the wind is extremely important for the greater Minnesota. Completely understand that, and the seabed legislation that we have in place has been very efficient for and very good for these communities too. And as the commissioner said about the property taxes and jobs, and just it's just another agricultural commodity, basically, is how I look at it. But and I'm glad you put a shout out to Mortensen's company, because I think a lot of people don't understand that they are. The largest, developers of that, and they've done a very, very good job. They're kind of quiet. They don't toot their own horn about it, but it's a huge, huge deal to keep it in Minnesota, those jobs in Minnesota. The thing that I just do need some clarification on, though, from you, Commissioner, is your comments about being we need to have a more consistent basis in the state. Yes. And I feel that we've done a very, very good job in this state as you and many others in this room have put in place, and myself and along this table, we've done a very good job with that. So I'm a little confused about the consistent basis, because when you start comparing Minnesota to other states and what they have as far as their standards, most of them that are higher than us include hydro. And it's just California that's got a higher standard than we have that probably isn't going to be met. No. Ours will be met. And we had a study last year, thanks to Senator Benson and her work, to look at the utilities and if they're going to be able to meet this standard. I think that's really important to do that. So I'm a little confused about that statement, a consistent basis, and push the legislature, because we can only push so far if we don't, and we can only go so far if we don't have that federal tax credit. We have nothing. And we need to keep that in mind, that there is a balance here. There is a balance.
And go ahead. Keep going.
That's all. Thank you, Mr.
You're absolutely right. It's a corporate tax credit, and I've had many battles with the chairs of the committee and Kent Conrad in North Dakota and Chuck Grassley in Iowa, both sides of the aisle. You know, why not give the tax credit to ordinary people? Those corporations that you're giving it to aren't even in your state. Well, the corporations won't build a wind turbine without the tax credit, as you well know, Senator. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate all the leadership from your family. I get all these people that come to the wind turbine and I tell them how great it is, this enthusiastic speech, and they finally say, well, what's the downside here? I mean, come on. Be honest with us. There is a downside. The wind doesn't blow all the time. And the worst of it is it doesn't blow enough in the summer, as you know. And we're a summer-peaking utility. A lot of air conditioners, especially this summer. So we do have to, I believe it's a mix of everything that we have, the nuclear and the coal, and the natural gas and the wind, but we can produce a lot more from coal. The one study I think that's best, the Union of Concerned Scientists, who helped us a lot when we passed our law in 94, 331 coal plants in the United States should close, including some here in Minnesota and North Dakota and that, because they're uneconomical. Those little coal plants, it costs way too much to generate electricity. And as a guy who's buying my electricity from a coal plant in North Dakota, I know that. My rates, I'm paying $200 a month now for electricity. So those plants need to close because they're uneconomical, and we need to bring more wind into the mix. But we still are going to have some baseload power. And to Senator Benson's question, that's absolutely right.
We will briefly, Senator Brown, Senator Benson, anybody else?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Nichols, I'm glad you pointed out what a benefit wind has been in your county. I live in Becker, where Xcel has their Sherco coal-fired plant, and that's been a huge benefit to our schools and our community. So I appreciate you pointing that out.
And it's a good plant and a pretty clean plant, too. You know, the smaller, older plants, and a couple of those up in North Dakota, are the worst in the nation. But they can get by with it because nobody lives in North Dakota, so they, you know, their air is still fairly clean. Well, they don't. I mean, a lot of people work there, but they don't live there.
It's a very responsible plant, and it employs a lot of people
in
our area.
Yes, it does, and it produces a lot of electricity, and we need it.
Yes, we do.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just did a quick search of the Department of Energy, did an analysis of federal subsidies for electric power by source, and oil and gas. 64 cents per megawatt hour is the subsidy. For solar, it's $675 per megawatt. So 64 cents for oil and gas and $775 for solar. And wind is $56 per megawatt. And so this is 2010 Department of Energy numbers released in 2011. And so I think when we talk about subsidies, we also need to talk about contribution and capacity. And so I favor an all-of-the-above energy mix. I did carry the hydro bill last year, but I'm also looking at price impact for homeowners and businesses who have to buy this. And so I just wanted to provide a little balance to the $700 billion, I think, was the number that was in for your subsidies. But they do contribute a lot to our energy base, and it's important to keep perspective.
I called the WIA so I could answer that question, and they didn't call me back yet.
Okay.
But I still go back to any utility can sign a contract now for about 3.9 cents per kilowatt hour. So it's pretty cheap for the consumer. Now, I agree. There is the tax credit, I know what it cost, $1.2 billion for 10 years for what they just passed. But there's a lot of years in there. So thank you for that answer. But the other thing is we have to remember is what it generates for our local economy, the jobs, and the property taxes we get in these counties. Now, we need to do a lot more around the whole state so that everyone benefits. It's concentrated a little too much in Senator Rosen's district in mind. We're glad to have it. And as farmers, we're glad to have it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner, and members of the committee. With that, that's the end of our testimony today. We will be meeting next Tuesday, I believe, as well. With that, the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.